leftover questions on the passage around breath meditation before we move on?
Mm-hmm. Is the distinction between so as to be a great fruit of great benefit as opposed to so as to bring before establishing the mindfulness to their culmination?
Okay, that's the second one is one of the examples of how to bring it to great fruit and great benefit when you're going to bring the establishings of mindfulness to culmination. Then the rest of the sutta goes on and talks about other ways. Because there's another passage where the Buddha is saying to the monks, you know, you really ought to practice breath meditation. And one of the monks says, oh, I already do. And the Buddha says, how do you practice breath meditation? And the monk says, I put aside thoughts of the past and thoughts of the future and just stay equanimous in the present with the breath coming and going out. Which sounds like breath meditation as you ordinarily hear it. And the Buddha says, okay, there is that kind of breath meditation, I don't deny it, but it's not of great fruit and great benefit. And then he goes into the 16 steps as an alternative. Because you notice what he's doing, you are manipulating things quite a lot with the breath. And so this is the way he would recommend that you develop breath meditation so that it would actually lead on to concentration and insight. Yes. Okay, it's the temperature quality in that you feel with the breath. Sometimes rough breathing will feel hotter, cool breathing will feel more gentle. You can also breathe in a way that can raise and lower your body temperature. I mean, this is how the Tibetan monks do that, you know, the fire practice and melting the snow and things. They just raise, you know, they do hot breath. And what you think is, what you think, you hold the perception of heat, say, in the center where you're breathing. Or if you find some other spot in the body where it's warmer, focus on the warmest spot in your body. Think of that spot, the heat radiating out with the breath together.
That's Jumo Yoga.
Okay, but it's also breath meditation. Yes.
You mentioned a parallel of Theravada, carrying it until we don't need it anymore, and the same with the raft. Mm-hmm. Versus Buddhism, carrying it until we need it anymore. Do you see that Theravada is the only path to enlightenment? I'm just curious of your use of that term versus Buddhism, for example.
What can I say? I tend to think it is. So, can I give you just a short answer? That's the short answer. Okay, fine. Okay. Yes. There's no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than video games. I mean, there's a phrase someplace in the canon where it says, jhana is the sport of the wise people. If you're going to have fun, this is how you have fun. Yes. But I've got you pretty relaxed, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
I guess my question is, through breath meditation, how much emphasis should be put on actively relaxing the body and letting go musculoskeletal?
I think, you know, relaxing the different muscles allows the breath energy to flow better. And so you can just go down through it and just think, okay, relax, 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 down the back, out the legs, or come up from the feet and do it the other way, whichever way you find more effective, and then with the hands up the arms. And especially for people who have trouble sensing any kind of energy flow, at least you can sense, okay, is it tense, is it not tense? And you can trust that if it's not tense, the energy is more likely to be flowing. Yes?
And using visualizations, like a directed
form. Yeah, when you're visualizing where the breath is going to go, there has to be an image in your mind. Kind of directing things.
Yeah, I use a lot of nature.
But you do also want to be in touch with the actual sensation of the breathing in the body. My teacher had a student one time whose powers of concentration were extremely strong, but she found that she would run into limitations when he was trying to get her beyond things that she could visualize, like getting into space or consciousness and that kind of thing, and she just couldn't hold a vision. And it turned out her problem was that she had never really related back to the breath. It was always focusing on the vision. So you've got to internalize it and say, okay, how does this relate to the breath? And then once you're more in touch with the breath, then the vision can go a bit more and more into the background. Okay, let's move on. We've got one more section. It's a big one, too. Jhana and discernment. And basically, what you're trying to do is realize, on the one hand, jhana can get very still and very calm, a strong sense of being released from your defilements, but it turns out the defilements are just hiding out. However, you do need to use jhana as a basis for discernment. All the passages in the canon where the Buddha talks about the arising of discernment, it's based on jhana practice. And it's either one of two ways. What you're trying to see is the fact that you've been working hard to get this mastered to the point where it seems second nature. And then you turn around and look at it and say, well, this too, even though it's very, very still and very, very calm, and in the course of doing that, you've become much more sensitive to layers of stress you wouldn't have been alert to before. But finally you get to the point where you realize, okay, this too has its inconstancy. This too is not totally dependable. I've got to find something more dependable. And so basically what the Buddha is doing is getting you cornered. He says you got really stuck on this jhana practice and cut off your attachments to other things. Okay, now, he says, okay, now learn how to let go of this and look for something that's unfabricated. And so two ways in which you look at the fabricated nature of jhana. One is to, as you go from one level to another, you begin to realize, okay, there's less fabrication in the deeper levels than there is in the higher levels. And the other is to just examine one level on its own. We talked about this a little bit earlier, that you're basically in the jhana the same way you'd be in a glove. And then you pull out a little bit, not totally out of the glove, but pull out just a little bit. And so you can examine what's going on in the mind and you realize, okay, this jhana that I'm doing here is composed of the five aggregates. And this is in response to, where's Amara? Here you are. This is a response to one of your questions. Okay. We have to talk a little bit about the aggregates in a minute. And so either going from one jhana to the next, you say, oh, this is basically put together. There's an intentional element here. And wherever there's an intention, there's going to be inconstancy. Is there some way that I cannot intend? That's kind of the riddle all the way through, is how can you not intend? And what happens is you begin to see that you either choose going for one fabrication or another fabrication. And the question is, what if I don't go for either? And an opening comes. And that's the end of that's the end of the fabrication, and that's the beginning of your experience of the deathless. But to see the jhanas as fabrications in terms of the aggregates, people always wonder why do they call them aggregates? Sounds like a pile of gravel. And that's related to a way of thinking that goes back to the 17th century that talked about the different ways you can look at piles of things or conglomerates of things. There are two kinds. There are systems and there are aggregates. Systems are when things work together for a common purpose, like your body is a system. All the different parts work with one another for the purpose of survival. Anything that has kind of an organic unity, they would call a system. Now, if it's just things lying around without any kind of organizing principle, those would be aggregates. And so when Buddhism was first discovered in the 18th and 19th centuries, that was the term they chose to use for the khandhas. The word khanda in Pali actually means heap or pile. So aggregate is pretty close. The idea being that you've got all these discrete things that you've put together, but they do not on their own work for a common purpose. It's because you put them together that they work to some extent, but it's all going to fall apart at some point. So that's why the word aggregate was chosen. The second one is, why did the Buddha focus on these five things? You've got body, and then you've got four functions of mind. Now, as we all know, the mind has lots of different functions. So what are these functions related to? If a person is, for example, if you have a particular type of physical skill, you will relate to your mind in one way. If you're an artist, you have certain ways of relating to your mind. If you're a mechanic, you will have other ways of relating to your mind. If you're an engineer, you think of your mind like a computer with software and hardware. Artists, however, think of the mind with using other analogies. So basically, what analogy is the Buddha using when he's talking about aggregates? And the nearest thing I can see is this whole issue of feeding. Think about when you feed on food. One, you've got the body, which needs to be fed, and you've also got bodies out there that you're going to feed on. And then the second question is, okay, feeling, there's this feeling of dis-ease when there's hunger, and there's a feeling of pleasure when you're fed. So it's the feeling that's driving you to eat. Perception is, on the one hand, identifying your hunger. What are you hungry for right now? You know, someone might say a nice thick steak, and then this other one will say, yeah, steak, disgusting. Falafel. And the first person says, falafel, that's rabbit food. So obviously we have different hungers. So first you have to use perception to identify the hunger, and then you have to use perception to identify what is it out there that you can actually eat to soothe the hunger. And this is a lot of what our experience of childhood is. We talked earlier about little children going around sticking things in their mouth. Well, that's one of the first things you want to perceive. What out there is good to eat, what's not good to eat. So that's perception. Fabrication is all of the activity you have to do in order to prepare the food. How you go out by finding it. Say you get a raw potato. You know, you've learned from experience that you can't eat raw potatoes, so you have to cook them. You have to do something with them. That's the fabrication part. And then consciousness is the awareness of these things. So the basic analogy the Buddha is using here for these five aggregates is the different activities you engage in order to feed. And this applies to physical food and emotional food and mental food. You say you're feeling, you get up in the morning, you have this feeling of dis-ease, and you can decide either it's, I need an ice cream cone or I need a new partner. Or I need to ordain. I don't know. So you've perception, you've identified, okay, what the hunger is and what you want. And then you figure out, how am I going to go about getting that? And so not only do we use these activities to feed, we feed off of these activities. This is how the mind relates to the world. We were talking earlier about how we tend to think in terms of becoming, and you hold on to that. Even before you've created a particular becoming, you're already thinking in those terms. In the same way that activities that we use in order to feed, we tend to like them. That's part of our identity. You know, basically, when you read a personnel ad, do they have personnel ads up in here? Personal ads, you know, personnel ads. Personnel ads or something else. When they have personnel ads, basically, this is how I like to feed. You know, long walks in the evening, sitting by the fireside, you know, that kind of thing. These are the pleasures I like to feed on. You like that, huh?
Yeah, it just strikes me as really wonderful that you're a monk in a hermitage or in a monastery and you know about personal life.
I wasn't born a monk, come on.
They haven't changed,
no. Although I did have a friend who went to India on the same program that sent me to Thailand, and he wrote a piece on one time comparing marriage ads in India to personal ads here in the States. Now, marriage ads are basically all business. You know, I belong to this particular caste. I'm looking for someone else in that caste. I'm of this social education. It's basically the parents putting out the ads. We're looking for a daughter or a wife for our son or a husband for our daughter. And it's all very businesslike and very practical. Whereas over here, it's more, you know, atmospheric.
And how much the lady has to bring into the marriage ceremony.
That's exactly, that's what they would discuss outside of the ad.
Nasty things happen about that.
Yeah, yes.
I won't go into detail.
Thank you. But basically what you're advertising, this is how I like to eat, and if anybody would like to provide a little of this food for me, I'd provide a little food that they like to eat, you know. And it's kind of, there's a exchange, yeah. Mutual eating society. Is what it inner being is inner eating. Yeah. So these aggregates are the way you feed off the world, both emotionally and physically. And again, you feed off the aggregates themselves. The word for clinging is also the word for taking food. So when we cling to the aggregates, we are actually feeding off our perceptions. We're feeding off our feelings. We're feeding off our fabrications. Because, again, the amount of time that we spend thinking about perceptions of food or thinking about feelings of how good it would feel to have this particular meal, or the amount of time we put in, devote into, I'm a really skillful cook, those kinds of things. We feed off of that on a second level. So we've got two levels of feeding going on here. And so what we've been doing, I mentioned earlier, of course, that jhana is a kind of nutriment for the mind. It's kind of a food for the mind. And you look at the practice, say, of breath meditation, and you see that you've got all five aggregates right there. You've got the breath, which is root form. You've got the feeling of pleasure that you've created by paying careful attention to the breath. You've got the perception of the breath that you're holding in mind, like the picture of the breath, how it goes through the different parts of the body. Fabrication here would be your conversation with yourself about how to fix the breath. If it's not good, how to get the mind to be adjusted so it feels just right with the breath. And then there's the consciousness that's aware of all these things. So you're given five aggregates in a form where you can eat on them and not get indigestion. This is basically skillful eating, skillful food for the mind. And then once you perform that, then you can use that as a source of nourishment for when you're trying to loosen up your attachments to other activities, other attachments. Because if you have nothing else, it's like, what do they call that with addiction therapy? Where they give you something to, a replacement therapy. It's a replacement therapy.
Surrogate.
I guess. It's something you take instead of the pot or the cocaine or whatever to give you a sense of well-being without the bad effects. So you've got the aggregates. These are still aggregates, but now you've put them in the form of jhana, put them in the form of the right concentration. They're food for the mind that nourishes you as you're learning how to let go of other things. For instance, sensual pleasure is not an easy thing to let go of. Sensual thinking is not an easy thing to let go of. But if you've got something better, it's easier to make comparisons and see, okay, this is a safer, more reliable, more satisfying form of pleasure here. Why should I go for the stuff that's going to create trouble down the line? And so use the jhana for that purpose. And then it gets to a point, though, where you've pretty much let go of your attachment to other things, but you're still very strongly attached to the jhana. That's when you turn around and start analyzing it as aggregates so that you can go develop dispassion for it and go beyond. And a couple of the passages here will go into detail about how that happens. For the purpose of our discussion, there are two other topics that need to be discussed. One is that it requires mindfulness in order to do this. So here's another use of mindfulness together with concentration. Okay, you've got the concentration and you have to remind yourself, okay, there's something better. And this is why the Buddha, even though he doesn't talk that much about nirvana or describe it in much detail, gives you enough to give you some reminders that this is really a better place to go. And then he also gives you reminders about this is how you would analyze the jhana in order to go beyond it. So that's another area where mindfulness plays a role. And then finally, the fact that okay, what you are left with is not nothing. You're not depriving yourself of anything. You're actually going for a higher pleasure, which lies outside of the aggregates, it lies outside of the sense fields. And as the Buddha says, if anyone thought that once you'd attain that, you would suffer, you'd feel suffering, he says that's the wrong way of thinking it. The right way of thinking it is when, as he says, when defiling mental qualities are abandoned and bright mental qualities have grown, and one enters and remains in the culmination and abundance of discernment, having known and realized it for oneself in the here and now, there is joy, rapture, serenity, mindfulness, alertness, and a pleasant abiding. In other words, it's a good place to stay, good place to be. So let's go through some of these passages. Passage 24 points out that you cannot really get discernment without jhana or jhana without discernment. 25 points out that if you want the kind of insight that's going to lead to liberation, it requires jhana. 26 points are things that you have to learn how to let go of, and just in order to get into the first jhana, you need at least some discernment into seeing the drawbacks of sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, uncertainty. In other words, you have to develop some discernment in order to get into the first jhana. In this case, it's discernment of the drawbacks of sensual pleasures. So that's one of the ways, again, in which discernment is required for jhana. Passage 27, and I'm going through this a little bit quickly because I want to get to it in detail to something else. This you can pretty much pick up for yourself. He says, you know, you do not automatically attain insight just by being in jhana. He says there are times when you've attained a certain peaceful awareness release, and as you're attending to that, your mind does not leap up, grow confident, steadfast, or firm in the cessation of self-identification. In other words, you're not learning how to let go. You're there, and it's good. You like it, and you said, I'm happy right here. They can tell me whatever they want. I'm going to stay right here. And the Buddha compares this to a man holding on to a twig, and his hand gets stuck with a sap. His hand would stick to it. Now, okay, this is one of the few passages in the canon where the Buddha actually talks about drawbacks for jhana, and it's pretty mild. You get the jhana, you get stuck on it. They're the lot worse things to be stuck on. So he doesn't harp on the top on the idea that jhana is a bad place to be or a bad place to, or a dangerous place to go. But he does warn you, okay, it doesn't immediately follow from jhana that you're going to want to go on to awakening. There has to be something to remind you that there's something better. There has to be a sense, okay, this is not yet good enough. There has to be the desire to move on. Also, passage 28 points out that it is possible for even a person with no integrity can get into quite a few of the jhanas. And how does he define a person of no integrity? A person of no integrity enters and remains in the first jhana. He notices, I have gained the attainment of the first jhana, but these other monks have not gained the attainment of the first jhana. You've seen this on jhana retreats, right? What jhana did you get into last night? Yes, Apijana, yeah. Okay. One exalts oneself for the attainment of the first jhana and disparages others. This is the quality of a person of no integrity. And you can actually get all the way up into the dimension of neither perception and non-perception and still lack the integrity. Not to compare yourself. So that's a dangerous thing you've got to work on. So just the attainment of jhana in and of itself is not a guarantee. I was mentioning this the other night. I think it bears repeating here for the group. When Ajahn Lee was first teaching in Bangkok, it was during a period when the senior monks in Bangkok had decided that jhana was no longer possible, that the time, the season for jhana had passed, and it was time for monks to become more involved in social outreach. In that case, particular case, they wanted monks teaching in elementary schools and high schools. And so he was coming in from having been trained in the forest tradition, and one of his first obstacles was to get people to realize, okay, people can still do jhana and still gain the noble attainments. And so when you read some of his books, and he talks quite a lot about jhana and how to get in there and how to develop it and how the breath meditation that he was teaching relates to the practice of jhana. He had other techniques as well. He taught meditation to a senior monk who had been very opposed to this forest tradition. The senior monk had been wanting the forest monks to settle down and become grade school teachers. Can you imagine what life would be like for us if Ajahn Lee had been a grade school teacher? It's hard. So what Ajahn Lee does is he goes and when the monk is sick, he goes and he sits in the monk's room. The monk had a fairly large room and he went and sat in a corner and just used the power of concentration of sent it into the monk. And the monk said, "What are you doing?" And Ajahn Lee says, "Making a gift of stillness." And the monk says, "Well, whatever it is, it feels good. Keep it up." And so as the monk was getting better, then he and Ajahn Lee started getting into conversation, and Ajahn Lee taught him how to meditate. And here's a senior monk who had never meditated in his life. He finally realized, oh, there really is something to this stuff they teach out in the forest. And so that was what led to the changing of the attitude in the Bangkok hierarchy. The other thing that led to the changing of the attitude was that he would teach people how to not only get into strong concentration, but some of them did develop psychic powers. My favorite story is the woman whose job was to clean the bathrooms in this one monastery, and he teaches her how to meditate, and not only does she meditate, but she also gets to read people's minds. So what does she do? She reads the minds of the monks. and then goes and reports to the abbot. So do you realize what these monks are thinking? So the abbot called the monks together. I don't know exactly how many details he told them, but that got them a little bit more, you know, afraid around Ajahn Lee. But by the time Ajahn Phuen came along, he'd seen the problem of talking too much about jhana, because a lot of Ajahn Lee's students would compare their jhanas. You know? And so when Ajahn Phuen was teaching, he'd hand out the book that mentioned jhana, but he would never discuss it. If you came to him with a meditation question, he'd say, okay, what's your breath like? Where is your mind centered? Okay, this is the next step. And he would never guarantee that you would reach this jhana or that jhana, and kind of discourage people from talking in those terms. Because what it comes down to is that regardless of what state you're in, what matters is how you analyze it for the purpose of understanding suffering. You know, you hit a state of concentration, and the question is, one, can I master it? Once I've mastered it, two, is there still any stress in here? And if there is stress, what am I doing that's contributing to it? Can I catch myself there and stop that particular activity? Remember what we talked about, alertness. Alertness is focused on your actions and the results. So this is the application of alertness to the jhana. And then the ardency, which is the desire, I want to do this more skillfully and again, have less stress. So starting with passage 29, we start going into the ways in which you can examine and analyze this. The Buddha talks about five-factor noble right concentration. So the first four factors are getting into the four jhanas. The fifth one is, he says, he has his theme of reflection well in hand, well intended, attended to, well pondered, and well penetrated by means of discernment. And here the analogy is this. Just as if one person were to reflect on another, or a standing person were to reflect on a sitting person, or a sitting person were to reflect on a person lying down, even so, you have your theme of reflection well in hand, well attended to, well pondered, well penetrated by means of discernment. What he's talking about here is the ability of the mind to step back or up a little bit from its concentration, to look at it and observe it, to see, okay, what's going on in here? Now, this requires a fair amount of skill, because a lot of people, they're either in concentration or out of concentration. And the next skill is learning how to pull out a little bit but not go totally out. And then when you're pulled out a little bit, then you can start analyzing it. The most detailed description of how you do this is in passage 30. Okay, first, I tell you the ending of the effluence depends on the first jhana, the second, third, fourth, all the eight attainments. Okay, I tell you the ending of effluence depends on the first jhana. Thus it has been said, in reference to what was it said? Suppose that an archer or archer's apprentice were to practice on a straw mat or a mound of clay, so that after a while he would become able to shoot long distances, to fire accurate shots in rapid succession, and to pierce great masses. In the same way, there's a case where a monk enters and remains in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, that should be, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. He regards whatever phenomena there that are connected with form, feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. In other words, anything in that state of mind, which is related to the five aggregates. You learn to perceive them as inconstant, stressful, a disease, a cancer, an arrow, painful, an affliction, alien, a disintegration, and that should be an emptiness, not self. I got hold of an old piece here, I guess. Okay, so you're looking at the state in terms of the five aggregates, and then you apply the perceptions of that lead to dispassion, that can be related either to the fact that they're inconstant, stressful, or not self. These are variations here, but they come down to those three types. Either it's inconstant, as for stressful, you've got disease, a cancer, stressful, an error, painful, an affliction, alien. The disintegration would be the inconstancy, a void, and not, or emptiness, and not self. That's the not selfness of this. Whichever one of those perceptions you apply that makes you develop dispassion for this. And then seeing that, you turn your mind away from this phenomenon in dispassion, and having done so, you incline it to the property of deathlessness. This is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, unbinding. So this is another perception you apply to incline your mind towards a happiness that is unfabricated, that it would be deathless. Now staying right there, you get one of two results. Either you reach the ending of the mental effluence, or if not, through this very Dhamma passion, this Dhamma delight, and through the total wasting away of the five lower fetters, self-identity views, grasping at precepts and practices, uncertainty, sensual passion and irritation, you are duly reborn in the pure abodes, there to be totally unbound, never again to return from that world. In other words, either you totally let go of your defilements, or you just develop a passion for the deathless. And in developing a passion, there's a new identity, a new becoming that you've created around that. But you've still reached one of the noble levels of attainment. So notice the stages in this. First, you attain the mastery of the jhana. You develop detachment from sensuality. And you base that concentration on your perception of whatever the theme is that you're holding to. Then you see the aggregates from which it's made in light of perceptions that develop a sense of dispassion. You incline the mind to a better happiness, which is the deathless, and then you try to stay there without developing passion for the deathless state. Now all this requires mindfulness, remembering, okay, this is what I have to do, but there must be something better. Incline your mind there, and then you have to remember, okay, once you hit the deathless, remember, don't hold on to it. And that's the way you reach awakening. So concentration and discernment and mindfulness all go together in this in several stages. This business about not holding on to the Dhamma passion or Dhamma delight, this is why the Buddha says that all phenomena are not self. Because you reach that point and you're about to create a sense of self around this new experience. And you've got to remember, okay, this too is not self. You've got to remember that. It's a lot of material. Any questions? How do I do that? Yes. Yes.
On passage 29, mm-hmm. He talks about the six higher knowledge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, let's see, clairvoyance, the ability to hear great distances, ability to remember past lives, the ability to read people's minds, psychic ability to display psychic powers or to gain awakening.
And is the term Dhamma Bhumin meaningful?
That doesn't apply there. These are called apinya.
Okay, but you reach that point enabling one to access those.
Okay, and again, you can access those depending on your past karma. Some people will have, as it says, wherever there's an opening, then you can access these things. Some people don't have the opening. And one of the reasons someone might have the opening is that they may attain awakening, but they've got a lot of karma they've got to clean up still. And there's a really fast way of cleaning up karmas with psychic powers. But some people gain the psychic powers before they gain awakening, in which case they can be dangerous. Because if you still have some greed, aversion, and delusion, these can actually magnify them. Yes.
Did the Buddha talk about past lives and reincarnation in the canon?
He talks quite a bit about the fact that it is a fact. He doesn't talk that much about specifics, what he was in his past life. And occasionally,
but he does refer to it as a fact.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't use the word reincarnation. He uses the word rebirth. Reincarnation has the idea there is a soul that leaves the body and goes into another body. And this is just the fact that it's a process that continues.
Gotcha. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in all the suttas that we've been reading here, Buddha is talking to the monks. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, does he talk about liberation for the householder in a householder kind of life?
Well, the times he's talking about householders about totally letting go or about when they're about to die or they're ready to be ordained. Now, living a householder's life, you have to realize you're handicapping yourself in a lot of ways. Because there's a lot of these things you can't do fully. But, I mean, my teacher had some students who were lay people. I'm convinced they were noble disciples. So it is possible.
I'm just curious in a way that you're presenting this material to, I think most of us are lay practitioners.
I think you are, yes.
We might not see a lot of the jhana material.
Well, I think it's useful to know about this stuff. Because, I mean, people will come and tell you all kinds of things about what the Buddha taught, and it's good to see, okay, this is what he taught. And then you can take what other people are teaching and compare them to, okay, this is what the Buddha said. And as I said, some lay people decide, okay, I really want to focus on this, and their families are encouraging, and so they, whatever spare time they have, they can devote to the practice and sort of keep up the momentum. Yes? Look for someone who you think is virtuous, generous, wise, and really does believe in the teachings on karma. If you have a teacher who doesn't believe in karma, you better stay away. Okay. But those are the four things that you want to look for in a teacher. I tend to trust monastics teachers more than lay teachers, yeah. I mean, that's why I went to Thailand and found a monk, yeah. Yeah. But it's a. Oh yeah, I mean you have people staying at the monastery for longer, shorter periods of time. Monasteries in Buddhist countries tend to be very different from Christian monasteries. I mean they're not cloistered. It's very much a part of. It's very open to people's coming and going. Mm-hmm. Yes. He's got a wide range of teachers in there. And if you're looking for, okay, this is kind of the smorgasbord of what the Theravada range is like right now, that would be a book to go to. Some of his discussions are based on his own biases in about the practice. The book I recommend, of course, is Each and Every Breath. It's available online. If you didn't get a copy off the table, it's online. You can, yes.
With respect, I'm wondering how much of the teachings you've offered us today have you experienced?
Okay, with respect, I have to tell you, I can't tell you what I've attained. Yeah. Okay. That there's actually a rule against that. Yes.
You said the suttas were available at Access to Insight. Is that your website?
It's actually was run by John Bullitt. He's kind of frozen it now. And so since then, we're starting to move the suttas over to Dhamma Talks as well. And we've got the Dika Nikaya in Dhamma Talks, and we're trying to work on the other ones, getting them ready. I think it's over here. Yes? Generous and virtuous and wise. Wise. And how do you know if someone has these qualities? You hang around them for a while and get to notice them. And the questions the Buddha has you ask is there any greed, aversion, and delusion in this person that would make him or her try to claim to know something they didn't know, or that would make them tell people to do something that was not for that person's true well-being? Which I think are two things you really want to look for in a teacher. Okay, one that you want to avoid someone who has qualities that whereby he would claim to know something he didn't know, or she would claim to know something she didn't know. And the second one was qualities that would make this person tell someone else to do something that was not in that other person's best interest. It's good to have a teacher because it cuts through a lot of It helps you avoid a lot of false paths.
But they're not in the personal ads.
Well, they come and visit Victoria occasionally. I don't know. We still have 10 minutes, so I can give you some more teachings. This is sounding very final. Anything else in the readings that sparked any other questions? Yes?
This is just following up on some of the other things that have been said. I'm not sure a question emerges from this that you will move to answer, but as I listen to these teachings, I become uncomfortably aware of sense of hypocrisy in itself, in that if one believed without doubt, mm-hmm. then it does seem like the household of life is not a wise path to mm-hmm. be following. I guess, would you say that there are wise reasons for one to remain, you know, living the household of life, even if they believe wholeheartedly? Or
in the time of the Buddha, there were some people who were noble disciples, but they had responsibilities that just could not leave. And so you have to look at your responsibilities. Do you have responsibilities to people that you really should not be abandoning? And you know, the Buddha left his wife, but he did come back and taught her how to become an arahant, which is quite an accomplishment. So he didn't just leave her, you know. And there was the case of Jitta, the householder, whose mother was sick, and he was the one who had to look after her, so he did not ordain. And so there are reasons like that. You've got children, you've got parents, you've got other people you've got to care for. Those are the good reasons to stay.
So it is wise to attend mm. to one's household.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who just don't make it as monastics, you know.
And where did the monastics come from?
They come from lay people. But then again, if there were no unenlightened lay people, you wouldn't need monastics. So that'd be
ignorance.
Right. Ignorance just, yeah, right. Yes.
In the last passage that we were looking at, I can't remember the exact phrases, but the sort of the final stage of dealing with the jhanas was that slight withdrawal you were talking about. Mm-hmm.
Okay, what it means is you focus on the fact, I've got to master this concentration. And you weren't here when we were talking about the analogy of the hunter. You know, you can prepare yourself, you've got your bow and arrow, everything ready. You go out and you cannot make a date with a rabbit. That, you know, I need my meal by 6 o'clock, so the rabbit has to show up by 4 so that we can fix it in time for the meal. You go out there and the most likely place to find rabbits, and you wait there and you're still and you're alert. And when the rabbit comes, you're ready to shoot them.
So the actual, is the word incline in that particular mm-hmm. section? So there is some sort of intentional directing, though, or?
Yeah, and it's not so much that you know that someday I should do this. That really comes up as kind of a heart quality. It says, I've had enough of that. This concentration is good. It's the best thing I know, but it's not good enough. And there really has to be that sense of, you know, it's you're disenchanted with it. You can't just say, okay, I've attained this, okay, now I'm inclined here. There has to be a disenchantment with this before you can move on. So how do you develop that? You work on developing a real mastery of the concentration so you're really familiar with it. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Since we're coming to an end, and I don't know if you're going to I have an opportunity to get to this. Could you comment on number 33? Because that just really...
Yes. Yeah. Me. Yeah. Okay. Okay, what we're talking about here, there is this other dimension that can be attained. And it is without birth, without becoming, it is not made, it's not fabricated. And it's because of that that we can escape from the suffering that's involved in fabrication and these things. And in another passage, he actually calls it a dimension that can be touched by the mind. This is in that dimension, there's no coming or going or staying in place. I mean, in other words, all the categories that we tend to think of in terms of becoming, of who I am and where I am, are gone. And it is this dimension that can be touched by the mind. Passage 34 makes the point that it's not a blanking out, it's consciousness in a new state, or a different kind of consciousness. The term consciousness without surface refers to an analogy the Buddha gave one time. He says, if you have a beam of light, and it comes in from the west wind, it comes in from the east window, where does it hit? And it says it hits the west wall. Suppose you have a building there. Okay, suppose there's no west wall, where does it hit? It hits the ground. If there were no ground, they had this belief that there was water under the ground, so I said, well, it's going to hit the water. If there's no water, where does it hit? It doesn't hit anywhere. It doesn't land anywhere. And the word to land there is also the word for becoming established. And they talk about consciousness becoming established at a place. And once it's established, that spot is luminous. It's like a beam of light. You can see the beam of light because it's hitting something. Here's a consciousness which doesn't hit anything. And so you can't see it. And so that's the analogy that the Buddha gives for this state. It's outside of the six senses. Because he goes on to say here, it's not experienced through the earthness of earth, liquidity of liquid, the fireness of fire, the windiness of wind, the allness of the all. Now the all here is all six senses. And this is something that's outside the six senses.
So it's a consciousness that can't be experienced in this reality?
It's a consciousness that is not experiencing this reality, and you can't experience it through this reality. But it has its own reality. It's a separate dimension. But it can be touched right here. That's the point.
A few quick tips on the difficult practice of celibacy.
quick tips. Learn how to see, visualize your body as all the parts inside. And then you look at other people and you see the same parts. That's good for all kinds of things, not just celibacy. It cuts through racism, it cuts through pride, it cuts through lust, all kinds of things. Anything else? Everybody satisfied? Okay, well, thank you for your attention. And I hope that these readings and discussions have been helpful.